So deterrence is weak. And when that happens around the world, our adversaries and our enemies will take advantage of that. And that first strike that they launch against us will be massive, bloody, and if it is done correctly, could be decisive.
You're listening to The Convergence, the Army's Mad Scientist podcast. I'm Matt Sanisbert, Deputy Director of Mad Scientist, and I'll be joined in just a moment by Rachel Melling of the Mad Scientist team. Mad Scientist is a U.S. Army initiative that continually explores the evolution of warfare, challenges assumptions, and collaborates with academia, industry, and government. You can follow us on social media at ArmyMadSci or subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. Today we're talking with familiar guest, Colonel Retired John Antel. John is a soldier, military historian, and leadership expert who served 30 years in the U.S. Army as a combat arms officer. We'll first hear Colonel Antel read his latest piece about a possible worst-case but realistic scenario for the United States, and then sit down with him for an interview into his writing, threats to the U.S., and how we should be preparing for a potential catastrophic event. As always, the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Army Futures Command, or the Training and Doctrine Command. And now, Colonel Retired John Antel.
The dictator's dream. Yet let's be content and the times lament, by John Antel. The monitor blinked. The image on the enormous screen flipped upside down for a full 5 seconds. What is this? The dictator barked. Sir, it is an emergency software update, a tall general in an immaculate combat battle dress uniform replied. The screen image flipped again, this time correcting itself to be right side up. Inside the command center, figures appeared like specters, each fully engrossed in their respective roles of monitoring, analyzing, and advising. The soft hum of the communications equipment mixed with their whispered discussions, generating an atmosphere filled with tension and anticipation. Our plan includes implementing the update at all our communication sites. The dictator nodded. An aide brought him a cup of tea. As the dictator sipped it, he thought about a line from a song that was running through his fevered brain. He whispered the words, "Rockets' red glare, bombs bursting in air." We will finally change the world order and wreak revenge for 100 years of humiliation. "Sir," the general asked, his left eyebrow raised in confusion. "Nothing," the dictator replied, placing the cup on the table in front of him. He knew he was both orchestrating and beholden to the complexities of modern warfare, and this briefing was critical. "Proceed with the update." The general nodded. "Sir, the American fleet, comprising a dozen U.S. Navy combat ships, 3 destroyers from Japan, and 1 from Australia, have passed our quarantine line and have docked to the island's major southern port. The 23 merchant ships they escorted during the incursion are in the port now unloading fuel and supplies." The dictator's expression remained indiscernible, betraying neither elation nor dismay. He thought about the events that had transpired in the past 6 tumultuous months. A world away, the war in Gaza continued unabated, and after suffering nearly 6,000 Hezbollah rockets and missile attacks in northern Israel, the Middle East had exploded. Israel launched a full-scale invasion into Lebanon to push Hezbollah forces north of the Litani River. Reacting swiftly, Hezbollah launched thousands of missiles toward Israel. A day later, Iran and its surrogates in Yemen launched massive rocket, missile, and drone attacks aimed at Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, Haifa, and other Israeli cities and settlements. Israel's Iron Dome could not handle the overwhelming attack, and as a result, Israeli casualties dramatically mounted and towns and villages burned. Hoping to avoid a war prior to the presidential election, the United States hesitated and then finally committed military forces to support the Jewish allies. In a massive movement of combat power, the United States military engaged with significant naval and air forces against Iran and its proxies. Consequently, Iran and its surrogates targeted American forces in the Middle East. The United States was now in a shooting war and taking casualties. The first part of the dictator's grand plan was unfolding. He saw the power of the forces he had set in motion. The momentum of the chaos was enveloping his enemy. This would consume more American resources and the military might of America's allies as the fighting escalated. Meanwhile, in Ukraine, Russian forces were attacking relentlessly, regardless of the horrendous losses in men and equipment. The Ukrainians were fighting bravely, desperately, but the weight of the Russian attacks forced a breakthrough of the Ukrainian defenses. Ukrainian forces fell back in disorder, and a mass refugee exodus from Ukraine began. The U.S. and NATO rushed to respond with an emergency resupply operation, but it was proving to be too little, too late. With mounting Ukrainian losses in both manpower and territory, the dictator expected Kyiv to surrender to a triumphant Russia despite American efforts. As the Americans were contending with the war in the Middle East and a faltering Ukraine, they were experiencing chaos at home. The contentious presidential election erupted in violence. On November 7th, when the winner of the election was announced, riots broke out in major American cities. The dictator's hybrid warfare forces, already surreptitiously positioned in the U.S., facilitated and supported these riots. Sabotage and violent false flag killings raged in cities across the U.S. Nuclear power plants and oil refineries were attacked by explosive-laden drones. Forest fires raged across the American Southwest, started by the dictator's hybrid special forces teams and facilitated by drug cartel gangs. America's national military and police forces struggled to maintain order. Sabotage, mass shootings, transportation disruptions, internet and communications outages, and attacks on the electrical grid, along with cyber attacks from unknown actors, disrupted American society. Just-in-time logistics broke down. Store shelves were soon bare. Looting was rampant. Several major metropolises plunged into darkness. Disorder consumed America at home and abroad. As this hybrid war played out in the United States, the dictator decided it was time to act against the renegade province that he had sworn to bring to heel. Rather than an outright invasion, his plan was more subtle, involving a siege and an ultimatum for a peaceful surrender. First, his military forces imposed a naval blockade, having practiced it multiple times in the prior 18 months during massive punishment drills. To increase the seriousness of this blockade, the dictator's naval and air forces deployed sea mines to block the major trade routes. The dictator then ratcheted up the pressure by imposing a naval quarantine. This included halting, boarding and detouring every ship sailing into the quarantine zone, then redirecting them to the mainland for confiscation. The dictator dared any foreign power to challenge these actions and declared that his air, sea, and rocket forces would only respond with force if provoked. Reluctantly, the United States reacted by assembling a fleet to protect a convoy of merchant ships, emphasizing this was not an act of war, but designed to ensure freedom of navigation in international waters. The convoy carried oil, natural gas, and coal desperately needed to keep the renegade island's lights on. With only 50 days of energy reserves, the quarantine of the island directly threatened the economy and the welfare of its people. After several weeks of this quarantine, the lack of energy reserves also severely hampered the island's capacity to produce the precious, high-end semiconductor chips that were vital to the U.S. to maintain technological dominance. This was an intolerable situation for the United States, and its leadership decided to break the quarantine and resupply the island. The Americans announced their intent to accomplish all this without resorting to war, signaling their military forces would not fire unless fired upon. Tensions heightened as the U.S., allied, and Chinese ships confronted each other. A single mistake could trigger open warfare. Who would blink first? Following a heated exchange of diplomatic messages and announcements, the dictator opened a corridor in the quarantine line, granting unopposed convoy entrance into the island's primary port. The Americans and their allies rejoiced in this victory and hailed it as a Christmas present for the free world. This was, however, all part of the dictator's plan. He believed the Americans had no stomach for a war for national survival and were fully distracted by other international and domestic conflicts. Seemingly oblivious to the unfolding threat, the Americans did not realize they had already essentially been at war since the Russian invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. The Americans are congratulating themselves on their show of force for breaching our quarantine, the general continued. They believe their actions deterred us, and tomorrow is Christmas. Dragon Day has finally arrived, the dictator said with a sinister smile. At last, the glorious moment is at hand. The general continued, tomorrow we will launch our attack. We have painstakingly massed our preparations. Our strike forces are at full alert and ready. Through our analysis of the war in Ukraine, we found that the first strike should be overpowering, decisive, and deadly. We are tracking the locations of Allied military forces by satellite, aerostats, aircraft, drones, and spies. We have real-time knowledge of their current locations. Our aim is to target 70% of American and Allied forces in the Pacific and continue our hybrid attacks to disrupt their forces in the continental U.S. We expect to catch our enemies unaware, with their aircraft parked on runways, their air defense and ballistic missile batteries lightly manned, many of their ships in port, and their troops in unprotected barracks. We also will hit their most important satellites with anti-satellite missiles, knocking out their eyes in the sky and disrupting their GPS navigation system. Our first strike will be devastating, and we will cripple our enemies' means to see, coordinate, and fight. We expect the full Dragon Day attacks to take 2 to 3 weeks, ensuring the United States cannot mount a significant military response for years. The Americans may even be so demoralized as to sue for peace. And the last update from our allies, the dictator demanded, will they do what they agreed to do? Every indication is the Russians will launch massive missile and hybrid war attacks on the U.S. and NATO forces in Europe. There will be no ground invasion. Simultaneously, North Korea will launch every rocket and missile they have against the four major U.S. bases in South Korea. But again, no ground invasion. They will avoid attacks on South Korean military forces to confuse the ROK-U.S. alliance. According to all our friends, they will launch their attacks 6 hours after we launch our initial Dragon Day strikes. The dictator nodded. Despite their agreements, his allies were still reluctant to commit until they saw his forces engage the United States directly. Friends indeed. We will publicly announce that we will not use nuclear weapons unless the Americans and the Allies launch in kind, the general continued. They will not risk nuclear war. We will make all our attacks with conventional weapons. Our nuclear forces are on high alert and will launch against targets in the United States, Japan, Australia, and the Philippines if there is any sign of a nuclear attack by any of the enemy's nuclear partners. Someone knocked on the heavy steel door of the dictator's room. The dictator suddenly woke from his dream and opened his eyes. He was still in bed, in his heavily fortified underground command bunker. He quickly sat up and gathered his senses. Everything he had just imagined was only a dream. But a smile crossed his lips as he took in that understanding. Sir, we are ready to update on our plans for Dragon Day whenever you wish. Good, the dictator replied. I will be out momentarily, and then we will see how we can turn the world upside down.
That was the harrowing The Dictator's Dream, written by and read by Colonel Retired John Antel, who joins us on the show today. John, this is your third time on The Convergence. One, thank you so much for coming back and talking with us. And two, thanks for sharing this story with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Matt. It's an honor to be with you today. And I just hope that our leaders will be listening to this and thinking about the possibilities and taking action.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about first, right off the bat. You know, after we heard the story here, give us a little background on how this story came about, why you chose to write it and release it now, and also what did you want people to feel from this?
Yeah, thank you. For the last several months, I've been working on different scenarios of possibilities that could happen in the next 6 months to a year. And I came up with several cases that I shared with a group of very smart retired U.S. military officers that I often talk with. And I discussed these with them. And basically, this thought experiment was war game back and forth until we came up with some ideas that made a lot of sense to me. And so I thought that I would put them together in a briefing. So I did, and I briefed them all on it. And it took quite a while. And at the end of it, they said, you can't show this to anyone. It takes too long. This is a very in-depth briefing. This gets really into the weeds here, John. Why don't you consider doing one of the things that you've done in some of your books, like The Next War, where you take a situation and you develop it in a fictional scenario and get their attention. So I said, okay, good idea. So I wrote this article, and my intent, again, is to get people to think. Now, I hope that none of this happens. I pray that we get through the next year, the next 7 months, and the next year without major conflict, and that we can avoid war. But it is clear to me and many others that American deterrence has dramatically been affected by events in the last several years. Right now, our enemies do not fear us. We have people like the Houthis, a tribe in Yemen, shooting ballistic missiles at our aircraft carriers and our naval ships in the Red Sea. So deterrence is weak. And when that happens around the world, our adversaries and our enemies will take advantage of that. So we live in a dangerous time, a very dangerous time, more dangerous so than I think than any other time in the 21st century. And I believe these next 7 months are going to be the most dangerous time for the United States in its history. So this means we need to think with foresight, to think ahead. We need to solve problems in the short term and create solutions for the long run. And that's my definition of foresight. And leaders with foresight will solve these problems as best they can. And when they don't have technological solutions, they will develop the leadership and tactical techniques and procedure solutions, the TTP, to be able to solve them. We really need to think this through. Warfare is changing dramatically. Just the use of small UAS, tactical drones in the battle space, has changed things dramatically in wars in Ukraine and in the Middle East. The drone is now the machine gun of the 21st century. And we have been slow to adopt that machine gun. And we've been very slow to adapt to its to kind of warfare. Now, we have a lot of people working on systems and a lot of people talking about things, but all of this needs to come together. And the leadership needs to be studying the wars of the last 4 years, taking those lessons into consideration, and then acting on them as fast as we can. And I'm concerned because I believe we're running out of time. And the reason I wrote this article now is that I believe that we have to prepare mentally for this. Imagine, just imagine, if it was 1941 and today was July, you know, 1941, you're in July 1941, and you've only got a few months before Pearl Harbor attack, before the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor. If you knew with certainty that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor on December 7th, and you were in our military at that time, what would you do to prepare? So the question I ask for every military leader out there, if you had to go to war tomorrow or 10 days from now or 30 days from now, are your forces ready? Is your team ready? And if not, what can you do to get them ready? Because we right now don't know when that war will start. And it's almost certain that we will not attack China. It's almost certain that we will not attack Russia. But if they decide to attack us, if they roll the dice, and out of that roll, they say the best option we have is to attack, they will pick a time of their choosing. It'll be a surprise. And that first strike that they launch against us will be massive, bloody, and if it is done correctly, could be decisive. So we have got to prepare for that. That first strike scenario is the worst case.
Sir, I think I'd like to start out with saying I felt like I was in an audiobook when we were listening to you just then. So I think that was a great rendition of your article. And I want to touch on a couple of things that you just spoke about and the idea that you've had before of useful fiction. So you just told us how this came about and how you had this thoughtful, impactful, informational brief, how it was maybe a little bit too long, and you were met with the feeling I think that we can all relate to of, ugh, not another brief, you know?
Yes, exactly.
So,
right.
Exactly. So I'd like to dive deeper into why you think useful fiction is so impactful for an audience and what you would like leaders to get out of it. Is it really to train that foresight in leadership and really why you chose to write it in this way?
Yeah, very good question, Rachel. Thank you. Useful fiction. You know, we can say that it's fiction and therefore it's not going to happen and we don't have to worry about it. Or we can read this and understand that this is a possibility that could happen. And in fact, we should prepare for it. I had came up with three different cases. This was the worst case. Preparing for case one, case two, and then case three, and this being case three, we should be doing all of those things. Now, what was interesting was that case one folded into case two, case two folded into case three, and that's why you had the worst case coming, because all of these things became like a stair step, because different options and possibilities arise. So our ability to use useful function to develop creativity and to think and to develop the foresight that I was talking about, I think is crucial. I believe that we need to be able to develop courses of action very rapidly. And you do that better with a good understanding of history and a good understanding of what is going on, you know, right now. So the question that I ask each of the listeners is, how many of you have studied the Second Nagorno-Karabakh War? And why is that relevant? Well, it was the first war in history to be won primarily by robotic systems. Yes, the war was not won totally by robotic systems. Drones are not a silver bullet. None of that. There is no game changer weapon. I hate the word game changer because it takes a full team and it's a holistic approach and the full spectrum of war gets involved. But if we don't learn the lessons from these wars and see how we need to adapt our forces to these challenges, then we'll always be behind. And then after the Second Nagorno-Karabakh War, you have the Arab-Israeli War of 2021, the first war in history to be won primarily by artificial intelligence. Yeah, no kidding. I mean, the Israelis put together a kill web, which is not a kill chain. A kill web is an AI-enabled kill chain where all of the weapons in range and all of the targets that are identified that are in range of those weapons can be applied automatically by the AI, synchronized and fired. That was tremendous. Our ability to learn from that is crucial. And we're working on things like that with JADC2 and other things, but we need to think through this. So this is a great example in history to read and to understand. And there's enough information open source on this that every leader can find this. And then, of course, the Russo-Ukrainian War, which is unfolding before our eyes every day. And you can see in that war how precision weaponry have had a great effect, how simple things like the protection of forces and trenches and the dispersion of command posts and all these other things are crucial. So we're living in a world with these massive disruptors to warfare, you know, what I call the nine disruptors. And these nine disruptors are changing how we fight. And one of the most important of them is the transparent battle space. Everything can be seen. So if you put together a command post with more than four vehicles, it will be a target that sticks out in the battle space and it will get hammered. And our command posts won't survive. Well, the same thing with all of our other formations. Now, four vehicles is roughly a platoon. There should be a lot of platoons in the battle space. So if we think about that, the enemy will have to figure out which platoons to hit. Now, they might just hit them all if they have enough weaponry, but nobody has everything. So they'll always have to make some kind of decision. But if you put 10 vehicles together and it's a brigade command post or a division TAC, they will see that, they will find it, they will hammer it. And that is the lesson of the Ukrainian war. And it's also the lesson of the war fighting in Gaza. And it's truly also the lesson from the Second Nagorno-Karabakh War. So in this transparent battle space, long range precision fires can be applied to almost any target set. And so we have got to get smarter about how to disperse, how to harden ourselves, what I call masking. And masking is the full spectrum, multi-domain effort to deceive enemy sensors and disrupt enemy targeting. So we need to deceive their sensors. You see that the battle is in deceiving their sensors. So we need to know what sensors they have. What are their primary sensors? How could we deceive them? Sometimes we can jam them. Sometimes we can't. We ought to, for instance, consider everything. You know, we have to be able to mask in the optical, which is camouflage. We have to be able to mask in the thermal, which is blending in with your background. We have to be able to mask in the electromagnetic spectrum, which means not talking so much on the radio and figuring out how to use our radios and our electronic systems less and use them more effectively. We have to be able to mask in the acoustic arena. We have when cannons fire, when the artillery goes off, the drones now have acoustic sensors and those are passive. So they can see, they can hear where that shooting comes from, triangulate on it, and know where to go to launch long-range precision fires. And then soon, in the next few years, quantum sensors will become a bigger and bigger part of warfare. And right now, quantum is affecting systems in many ways, helping to make them stealthier or helping them to find stealth capabilities. For instance, the Chinese are developing quantum radars that will find stealth aircraft. So all of these areas we have to be able to mask in. And these are crucial things that you can learn from the wars of the last 4 years. We should be studying these in all our schools. We should know what they are. Our soldiers, our leaders need to understand the lessons learned and then apply them. And we've got to be faster at doing this because we're slow to adapt to these changes and slow to adopt some of their main weaponry. For instance, I repeatedly say that small UAS tactical drones are the machine guns of the 21st century. Now, the machine gun was a smart weapon when aimed by a trained human soldier. Its effect on warfare was dramatic. At the Battle of the Somme on 1 July 1916, the first day of the battle became the bloodiest single day in British military history. Over 18,500 Commonwealth soldiers were killed that day. Now, small UAS aren't killing that number of people every day, but they're having a tremendous effect on the battlefield by freezing maneuver and by being able to strike any target that sticks out, any target that is more than one or two tanks, one or two vehicles, maybe a squad of soldiers. So all of this is changing warfare, and we need to understand it, and we need to adapt and develop the leadership in TTP to bridge the capability gaps that we have right now concerning drone warfare.
Well, so on that line, you know, the events depicted in the story, you mentioned how we need a holistic approach, and certainly the events in that story require a whole of government, whole of nation approach to something. But we in the Mad Scientist, you know, we are part of the U.S. Army. So let's say you had the chief of staff, the vice chief, and a room full of 4 stars at your disposal here. What would you tell them specific to the Army? Why the events here are important?
Well, that's the critical question. And I love, Matt, how you always zero in on those. So you're good at that. You know, they have many things they have to think about, and that will tell you how busy they are. I will also tell you that we should never be too busy to study war and study the most recent wars in particular. We have got to move our thinking forward first. So, for instance, let me just give you a basic example of what we could do. We conduct war games all the time at almost every level. We have theater war games. We have you know, corps have war games. We have war games at division level. How many of those war games that you know have ever started with an enemy first strike on our forces? Well, the answer is few, if any. We're thinking in the old way. Okay, we're thinking in the old way. We are thinking Desert Storm. Now, we love that idea. Go someplace, build up a huge mountain of all sorts of great stuff, pick the time and date of the attack, strike the enemy first, and then attack. Well, now let's reverse that. The enemy is going to build up its forces, but dispersed, because you can now mass fires by being dispersed. You don't have to mass all your cannons hub to hub. You can put your rocket forces all over the place. They can mass all that and we won't even know it. And if they want to strike us first, they'll pick the day and time of their choosing. So our war games should start off with a first strike against our forces. Now, many would say, well, that wouldn't be fair. And I would say, hey, that's war. And you could just roll the dice as to who would be knocked out. So, for instance, imagine if you had, you know, a division war game going on and you had the brigade spread out over some area, and let's put them in peacetime configuration in Poland or something. What would they do? Do they have dispersal areas to go to if they get struck? Do they have bunkers to run to? Do they have foxholes to jump into? I brief soldiers all the time, soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and allies, mostly through MS Teams, but sometimes in person. And I've given over 430-some presentations since 2021. And one of the questions I often ask, particularly when I'm in person, is how many of you here have ever dug a fighting position to standard in the last year. Very few hands are raised. Now, that doesn't mean you win a war by digging fighting positions, but you certainly won't survive if you're on top of the ground and the artillery hits. So when you go to the National Training Center or to any of our CTCs, for instance, we need to be looking very carefully at what we're training. Now, we're doing some wonderful things there, and there's good people there working hard. I got it. And we've added drones to the NTC and to other CTCs, and that's great. But we don't really have a capability amongst our forces for effective counter UAS. We need to think this through. So we can do a lot of this mentally. We can war game the whole counter UAS thing. Just ask, for instance, the next time you go to any Army or Marine unit, what is your battle drill for drone attack? And if they look at you like you're crazy, we have a problem. You know, if you're a command post, what is your battle drill for tactical SUAS drone attack? What would you do? FPV drones are coming at you. What do you do? I mean, other than get hit and die, you've got to figure things out. So how do we do this? Starting to think through that TTP is very valuable. Some people say we'll solve this problem because we'll jam them all. They'll fall from the sky like rotten apples. It won't be a problem. I doubt that. If you are actually paying attention to what's going on, the technology is advancing very rapidly, and the ability to have a basically unjammable drone or a very difficult to jam drone that will be able to fly very low and get through and run by artificial intelligence that needs no operator, but is looking for its target. This is where we're headed. So we've got to think this through. Counter UAS has to be the complete, you know, spectrum of things, from jamming to kinetic, all of those things. We've got to think those through. And we don't have a good defense for top attack across our military. And we don't have enough sources. We don't have enough resources. We don't have enough air defense sources to do this. And for instance, one of the things that we should be thinking about is how would we deploy and apply small UAS to our tactical units? And the answer is, well, we'll treat it like a piece of ammunition. Our soldiers are smart. They can figure this out just like that. We'll give them the drones. Okay, war game that for me. Just war game that for me. Think about it. So you have a platoon and you say, hey, here's 10 drones. There's four FPV drones. There's four bomber drones. And there's two ISR drones. So you got 10 drones. Have fun. What does a platoon do with those? Do they take an entire squad out and have the squad operate that and then only have two maneuver elements? Do they issue them to everyone so that while they're maneuvering, they can't have time to use them? How would they do that? How would you fight with them? We've got to think this through. Now, what other armies have done would be something to start studying. What have the Israelis and the Ukrainians done? Well, the Ukrainians have created a drone corps where they train their operators as best they can, because it takes months to train a good first-person view operator, drone operator. The FPV drone operators that are good, they take months, if not longer, to be capable, because those drones are not easy to fly, no matter what anyone thinks. We might say that the millennial generation or the younger generation now can pick up a drone and just go like that, but just ask them how many have flown a drone lately. In an average unit, I ask the question, how many of you have flown a drone? There's maybe 300 soldiers out there have flown a drone in the last 6 months. Two hands, and they're doing their own hobby drones. So our challenge is if you don't train for it, you're not ready. You do not rise to the level of your expectations. You fall to the level of your training. So we've got to think these things through. And one of the things we could do is, again, we could do the wargaming piece where the enemy strikes us first, and we could adapt from there and see how it would go. The other thing we could do is at our CTCs, for instance, we do the Desert Storm model at the CTCs. We arrive by train or by plane or whatever. We get off. We have this admin period. Everything's great. We get our equipment, and then we kind of move out to a place, and we start the war. In what world will that ever happen? So if that is not what's going to happen in the next war, and in fact, we're coming off the train and going straight to dispersed and camouflaged and masked positions, shouldn't that be what we do? Shouldn't we immediately go to mass positions and immediately try to figure out how to do distributed mission command, which is a whole nother piece we could talk about some other time? You know, we need to be good at mission command, but we need to also figure out how to do distributed mission command, which is the the ability to execute mission command without staff co-location. Think about that. You know, dispersed to the point where you have redundant and resilient command posts and capabilities. So there's a lot we need to be thinking about, and it starts here. So we can do a lot. And what I'm very tired of hearing from people is not what we can't do. I want to know what we can do. You know, don't tell me what you can't do. I hear that all the time. Tell me what you can do. You know, can you develop the tactics, techniques, and procedures? Can you do thought experiments and war games and whiteboard exercises and train model exercises that go through this? Like, who's in charge of the counter UAS fight? How are we going to coordinate all that? How do we use drones in the offensive operation? Why don't we have, for instance, tankers that are going down tank qualification tables, learning how to fight their tank? Why aren't they talking directly to or seeing directly what a drone sees and having targets designated by the drone? Why aren't we thinking about how to integrate into all those qualifications the weapons of the time? I mean, it is as if we understand the machine gun exists, but we don't want to use it. So we've got to start doing that. And that's a sea change in thinking. And that's just the Army. I mean, Air Force and Navy, we have all sorts of other challenges there that I could talk to you about. But there are many people out there that see all this, but putting all the dots together is hard. And so the idea of using this useful fiction was, hey, let's grab their imagination and get them thinking about this. They'll come up with great answers. I certainly don't have all the answers, but together we can come up with some great solutions. And we really need to develop at the unit level, all the way up to Army level, you know, the TTP that is necessary to fight in the modern battle space. And that takes thinking leaders, wargaming, thinking, thought experiments, having a very constructive dialogue to create and put all that together.
So I want to pivot a little bit and ask about one specific thing that I picked up on in your story that links to something that we've been talking about within the TRADOG G2. So we've started to use a term that is circulating throughout the Army to describe the relationship between the U.S.'s adversaries, and that term is authoritarian collusion. And we've been using this term to show that there is some sort of collusion or maybe some sort of bond, but it may not be strong enough to call it a full-blown partnership or alliance at this time. In your story, though, the dictator clearly refers to other U.S. adversaries as his allies, which I thought was interesting. So can you elaborate on why you chose to define their relationship in that way? Do you see this as being a possibility in the future that their relationship may be strong enough to classify it as an actual alliance?
Right, Rachel. Great, great, great question. Our challenge today is that our enemies, and I use that term because they are our enemies, they are, in fact, working together in ways they never have before. You see in Russia now, Putin just had a trip to North Korea. Last December, he had a trip to Iran. I mean, he is purchasing the methods of war, the drones from Iran, the artillery shells from North Korea, and now he's even getting engineer troops from North Korea that are going to be supporting him. So what more do you need to know that North Korea and Russia are in fact allies? And they have a defense pact now that they've just re-signed. And of course, North Korea doesn't do anything without China's consent. I mean, Kim has to take the little train all the way to Beijing to get, you know, blessings on stuff. So if the Chinese were going to do a first strike against U.S. and allied forces in the Pacific, you can bet that the North Koreans will also be involved somehow. And how would they best be able to do stuff? So I put that into the article by having them using their long-range precision fires in a first strike against U.S. forces, and only against U.S. forces, trying to split the alliance. If you read Sun Tzu, The Art of War, you can see all of the sort of the nuances throughout the article about how the enemy's thinking. Now, our challenge is that we can blow this off and say, oh, they won't do this. I mean, that is too out there. That is just, I can't believe they would attack us. And then you have to think about what those people were thinking, you know, at 8 o'clock in the morning on December 7th, 1941, when Japanese planes were flying right above them. I mean, imagine the shock of that. Now, I was talking to a retired general officer not too long ago who said, well, Chinese don't have weapons that can range Pearl Harbor. Of course they do. And not only that, the Japanese did in World War II. So if you wanted to be nefarious and you wanted to be very diabolical, you could think of a million ways that you could get forces close enough to launch against Pearl Harbor. And the same thing goes for the United States. So I wanted to bring that up in the article. I mean, hybrid war is one of the ways that great powers fight conflicts short of nuclear, tripping the nuclear war line. So one of the things they can do is they can do hybrid warfare against us. Now, Russia believes they are at war with us. Lavrov just recently said, last week, said, the U.S. and Russia are no longer at peace. Well, to me, that sounds like we are at war. I mean, if you're not at peace, what are you? Okay, so he's saying basically in his mind, hybrid war. So the Russians would love to see us in pain and agony. How could they do that? I mean, we just had major forest fires raging in the American Southwest. If you peel the onion back on some of that, you'll find that some of those fires were set by humans on purpose. Now, only the FBI and others know for sure where all that's happening. But burning forests was used in the Second Nagorno-Karabakh War, and it was used as a means to drive forces away from strategic areas and to also to inhibit drone usage. The Israelis along the Lebanon border in northern Israel have experienced in the last few weeks tremendous forest fires set by Hezbollah on purpose to burn out Israeli settlements. All these things are hybrid warfare acts. And there are so many hybrid warfare acts that could happen in the U.S., and we don't know who's coming across our border. We have all sorts of people that are coming from every country in the world. If only 1% of the 11 to 18 million that they say have crossed, only 1% had ties back to some agency in their home country and wanted to disrupt the United States. Imagine that. 19 terrorists took us down on 9/11 and brought us to a close for about a week. Imagine 600. Imagine what could happen. So this is very scary, and we need to be very serious about how we apply it. And we could end up in a war for national survival, which is something most people can't imagine. So therefore, I want people to imagine it. We could be in a war for national survival in days or months. So we need to get serious about a lot of this. You know, if you look at history in World War II, you'll see that leaders with foresight were able to move us in a way that set us up for victory. You know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt developed the arsenal of democracy. And he was able to put a guy named William Knudsen in charge of, who was the president of GM, to give up his job at GM and work as the organizer for the arsenal of democracy. This guy worked for $1. That's all he asked for. He asked for $1. He wasn't even paid. And he was promoted to lieutenant general and a civilian, no kidding. And he commanded basically the coordination of the arsenal of democracy, which we need now to be thinking about. We cannot produce enough equipment. We cannot produce enough weaponry. We cannot produce enough ammunition. We have two plants in the United States, basically, that produce 155 millimeter artillery shells, and it's not enough. So all of this needs to be thought about. And we have, in the past, been very efficient because we were trying to, after the Cold War ended, we wanted a peace dividend. And so we decided that we would use this very efficient means to produce just exactly what we needed and nothing more. But wars aren't like that. Wars are full of waste. And they require tremendous mass. We won World War II for many good reasons. And for the bravery and courage and leadership that we had was tremendous. But also we outproduced the enemy dramatically. We were building a plane every hour and a ship every day in 1944. Yeah. Now, you could say things were simpler back then, but I would tell you they were as complex at the time systems that existed. So we could do a lot of things. Now, should we go to a full war, economy? Should we mobilize the forces? Should we have a draft? Those are questions we need to think about. Because if in fact a first strike occurred, as I depicted in the dictator's dream, most of our current military forces would be gone and we would have to rebuild our military. And that is not an easy thing. So thinking through all this, again, worst case, and I pray to God that nothing, none of this will ever happen. But if we're not thinking about it and we're not getting ready for it, then we have no means of deterring it. You know, if you stayed up front, if this was to happen, this is what we're going to do. Maybe you can have a deterrence. Maybe you say, hey, if anybody strikes us first in Europe and they hit us, even with conventional weapons, we will reply with nuclear weapons. Now that would be, people would scream and cry and go all sorts of stuff. That's an attempt to reestablish deterrence. Now it is extreme because we're at an extreme stage now. We've lost deterrence. So, you know, we are attacking now. The Ukrainians are sending ATACMS and HIMARS missiles into Russian territory. And we are giving them the targeting data. And the Russians know that. So they want to hit us somehow. They want to strike back at us somehow. And all the sanctions we put on them have cost them a lot of money. So they want to strike back at us. And they'll have opportunities to do so. I mean, right now we have a heightened sense of alert in Europe. So 4th of July, who knows? We have forces in Europe that are on a higher security status because there's some kind of thought that maybe there'll be an action against them. Now, no one's explained what it is. And I hope that the leaders in Europe know what's going on and are preparing properly. And I'm sure they are. But nonetheless, our situation is such that we are in too many ways easy to kill. And we've got to get harder to kill.
Lots of great points there. There's a couple that I want to kind of focus on. You know, you mentioned the number of personnel we have in the military right now. And I would urge people to go look at the casualty rate in the Russia-Ukraine war and then compare that to the number of active personnel we have and see just how difficult it might be if we get into one of these wars to rebuild our forces and reconstitute them. The second is, and this is, I think, maybe the most important thing you mentioned in here, you know, you wrote this because a lot of people can't imagine something like this happening and you need to help them imagine it. And if you've been listening to the Mad Scientist Initiative for the past 8 years, you'll know that we like to bring up the 9/11 Commission's findings on failure of imagination. You know, one of the three findings was it was our failure of imagination to prevent what happened on 9/11. So I think it's incredibly important that we help people imagine these scenarios, because if you're not imagining them, you're not thinking about them. If you're not thinking about them, you're not going to come up with a solution or a preventable measure. So I think that's incredibly important. I'd like to ask you one final question, and it's not really a question. It's more of an open statement here. What else would you like to tell us and our audience that we haven't covered here about this topic or anything related to national defense?
Well, I wrote this article, The Dictator's Dream, as a wake-up call to our leadership to get them to really focus on a worst case. We have many advantages. We are a great nation and a great people. And we have, in the past, risen to almost every occasion. So I have great faith in the United States of America, and I am long on our view that our republic will survive and that we will thrive. But we will go through some really tough times if we don't think ahead. We need to develop foresight. We need that ability to solve problems in the short term and create solutions for the long run. The more we can war game red team, think through these courses of action and prepare, the more that our leaders are able to apply leadership and develop the tactics, techniques, and procedures to bridge the capability gaps that exist, because we'll never have everything we want. And we'd love to have the easy button that puts all drones down. We'll never get that. We need to be able to do that with leadership, tactics, techniques, and procedures. We need to think through how we do combined arms operations and how we need to adapt it into what I'm calling MDO combined arms. In other words, a combined arms that is much more integrated and much more understanding of the nine different disruptors that I often talk about and how we would use them. So all of these things involve thinking and leadership more than they do anything else. It's within our power to do these things. And if we don't, well, we're the professionals. The people, our citizens, expect us to know this stuff, expect us to act in time. They expect us to defend them. That's why they pay us. So we have got to do this. We need more people thinking and discussing it. And I would love to get any responses from anyone out there who thinks that I, you know, I'm way off base, or that I, in fact, am on target, whatever you think we could do. But the discussion is so important. And we need to talk. We need to think. We need to act. And we have so many good leaders out there. I meet them all the time, from generals down to privates who just really work hard and believe in what they're doing. But we need to focus our thinking. We have very fuzzy thinking in many, many places. We need to focus that thinking. And you focus that based on your study of recent wars, the study of history in recent wars, and a longer study in breadth of what happens in wars. I mean, understand what happened in World War I. Understand the reason why they went to the trenches when they were faced with machine guns and rapid-firing artillery. See why that applies to the fighting in Ukraine, those kind of things. Our leaders need and do this all the time, but we need to continue to refresh that study. So the use of useful fiction like The Dictator's Dream is designed to impel people, to get them inspired to do that.
Powerful and very directed words from our good friend of the Mad Scientist Initiative, Colonel Retired John Antel. The article is The Dictator's Dream. We've got it up on the blog, so you can, if you want to read it for yourself, it's up there. And if you have any feedback, we'll get it to John. Make sure that the conversation starts and the discussion happens. I have a sneaking suspicion this won't be the last time you're on our podcast, but it's always a pleasure when you come and talk to us. So thank you so much for sharing The Dictator's Dream with us, discussing it, explaining it, and, you know, being the one to start this conversation with everybody.
Well, thank you, Matt and Rachel, and God bless all of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines out there who are listening, you know, and also Guardians. We need everyone involved in the fight. It is a full spectrum, multi-domain effort, and we have to get all these leaders thinking and preparing, because we never want to be in a situation where we said we did too little, too late. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thanks for listening to The Convergence. I'd like to thank our guest, Colonel Retired John Antel. You can follow us on social media at Army Mad Sci, and don't forget to subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. Finally, if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider giving us a rating or review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you accessed it. This feedback helps us improve future episodes of The Convergence and allows us to reach a bigger and broader audience.